Dr. Arup Mangalik lives now in Albuquerque, but previously he practiced medicine here in Denver. And he has a brand new book out. It's called Dealing with Doctors, Denial and Death, A Guide to Living Well with Serious Illness. Great to have you in the studio. Thank you.
Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about your own work, as you're an oncologist.
I'm an oncologist by training. I trained in India and also in the U.S., but I've been practicing and working in the U.S. now for the last 40 years. And I worked as an oncologist at the University of New Mexico Cancer Center. I retired 3 years ago, and since then have been working on this book. Even while I was working as an oncologist, I was involved with medical ethics, and especially in the realm of limits of medicine, making doctors and patients understand that medicine cannot cure everything and that there are limits. And gradually, I've shifted into more and more of that and less of doing oncology. And of course, since I retired, I'm not seeing any patients, but I give talks about death and dying and acceptance of death and limits of medicine. The big part of this, my effort, is to increase communication between patients and doctors. And that's a big thing, a big part of my feeling, that doctors and patients don't communicate very well for a variety of reasons. And that leads to many times unnecessary treatments which are not likely to be helpful.
Well, we're going to get into all of that in this interview, but I'd like to hear a little bit more about your own personal experience in your family. And, you know, the book is A Guide to Living Well with Serious Illness, but a lot of what we're going to talk about is also dying well with a serious illness and how that fits in to our modern medicine system. Tell us about your parents and how that's informed.
My mother died when I was only 6 years old, and this was back in the 40s. Things were very different, and death was covered up. And my mother died in the hospital. I was never told about her death. I was sent to live with an uncle for a few days, and I found out about her death from my classmates rather than from my family and my parents.
And do you think that was with a view to shielding and protecting you?
I think it was. I never asked my father about that, but I presume it was related to the idea of shielding me from her death, which, of course, was worse than finding out directly. So that was very sad. And my father's death was even more tragic, because he was in excellent health and rapidly deteriorated. And within a matter of 3 or 4 months from being perfectly healthy, he got to a point where he was on continuous oxygen. And he was in the hospital for 3 months on oxygen. In all those 3 months, and even before, but especially in the last 3 months of his life, nobody ever talked about death. It was just, today the appetite is not good, we'll give this medication, and today the coughing is more, so we'll give that medication, but nothing else was discussed. And then his heart was failing. We had no idea why the heart was failing, but we kept on doing the day-to-day things. And then his heart stopped, which obviously it will. We tried to do CPR on him, which is absolutely totally ununderstandable to why would somebody try to do that, but that's the way it was done. And that impacted me a lot, and it has affected my thinking about why do we not tell people about bad things, because they're going to happen, and yet we do not stop them from happening. We cannot stop them from happening, but we keep trying, and we keep try to hide those things from the patients and the family.
Well, those two themes that you experienced, a lack of communication, not discussing when somebody has died, but also when somebody is dying, and then medical intervention, even when all hope is lost, and the impact, the negative impact that can have. And these are themes, obviously, that you deal with in your book. But tell us, particularly that thing about medical intervention, giving CPR to somebody who is dying. That, I mean, actually, as we listen to that story now, there's so much awareness about, you know, DNRs, do not resuscitate, and people having a little bit more autonomy. When you were practicing medicine, particularly as an oncologist, you're dealing with people very often with a terminal disease. what was the attitude in general medical practice about interventions, particularly when people really did not have much hope?
Many, many doctors are unable to say that we have no further treatment, you are going to die, and let us focus on keeping you comfortable. I have had colleagues who would send a patient to me with the idea and asking me to give another treatment. And I asked the doctor, can I talk to this patient about comfort before death, hospice and palliative care? And the doctor would say, oh yeah, sure, go ahead. But the point being that he could not himself talk to the patients about the bad news. But he wanted, therefore, his own idea was to give another treatment and not bring up the question. But he was okay with the phenomenon, but he couldn't do it himself. And that is unfortunately very common. And going back to my father's time, at that time, the concept of DNR did not exist. Every person whose heart stopped was subjected to these resuscitative measures, which were completely useless, in fact, traumatic, worse than useless, and yet it was the norm. It's only in the 70s, I think, that gradually the concept of patient being allowed to refuse those kinds of treatments started building up. And thankfully, that is an option which everybody has. But the default position still in every medical facility is that if somebody's heart stops and if the person has not said no, then they will be subjected to the brutality of CPR.
Do you think that is because the fundamental ideology within modern medicine, particularly here in America, is that death is failure? That if a doctor admits that somebody is dying and doesn't do everything they can, that's somehow an admission of failure?
Yes, I think that is very big part of all that. People, doctors do think that if a patient dies, that's a failure, and they try to compensate for that by trying something which they often know is not going to work. And also it was the default position of medical practice. So therefore, if you didn't do CPR, people were afraid that they would be considered not doing the right thing. Gradually, as I said, the idea has progressed, and now people are given the option of refusing. And sometimes it is explained to the patient properly, and sometimes it is not. But at least that option is available and done.
How much is money playing into this? Because a lot of times these interventions are very expensive, and either health insurance companies don't want to pay for them or doctors want to bill for them. I mean, is that a component?
Yes, money is a component. It is impossible for me or anybody to say how much of it is money. But certainly every procedure that is done in any medical facility is paid for. Either the insurance or Medicare will pay for it, or if you don't have the money, you are liable to pay for it yourself. But the doctors will bill for it and expect a payment. CPR itself is expensive. But even before the CPR, if somebody has a progressive heart failure or progressive cancer which has not responded to treatment, any attempts you do in the intensive care unit or in the other part of the hospital, any intervention a doctor undertakes will be paid for. So that is an incentive. Again, I will not say that the doctors do it because of the money, but some doctors do, and the system is there, which makes it feasible for the doctors to undergo that money issue.
Well, on the flip side of that, now that we are seeing more patient autonomy, where people are aware that they can refuse treatment and certainly have something like a DNR, do not resuscitate order, how much does money play into those decisions if people are concerned about being a financial burden on their family or not having health insurance that will even pay for this?
Most patients at the time of the serious illness will not say, don't give this treatment because we don't have the money, we don't have the insurance. The emotions at that point are such that people would like to not use money as their reason. And so if the doctor explains to the patient and the family the medical reality, then it gives them the option of deciding one way or the other. And also it is not something which is going to cause guilt. But if they are told that, well, it will cost you so much money to get this treatment, and therefore do you want to take it, that would be something that patients most likely will say, I don't care how much it costs, I do want my brother to live. And therefore, it's a vicious cycle. And again, communication, proper communication, honest communication is what we need.
We're speaking this morning on KGNU with Dr. Arup Mangalik, who is a retired oncologist. He currently lives in Albuquerque, but he practiced for many years here in Denver. And he has a brand new book out called Dealing with Doctors, Denial and Death, A Guide to Living Well with Serious Illness. We've talked a lot about dying. What about living well with serious illness and all that entails?
Yes, that is the most important point in this book, that you have to accept basic fact that we are going to die. Once you accept that, then you can choose your path. You have the right to choose your path, and if the doctors communicate well, then you will be able to make good choices. Acceptance that the treatment that has been given for the particular disease or the nature of the disease is such that there is no medical treatment for it, and therefore death is inevitable in that illness, from that illness, then it is appropriate to make the decision on that basis. The key is for you to be given proper information that this is really true. You can always say, we can never be absolutely sure. Sure, one can never be absolutely sure. But reality and reasonable choice chances are that this particular treatment will not work in this disease. And many people don't seem to be able to get grasp that. And they often say, oh, because I'm old, you are not giving me this treatment. Because I'm poor, you are not giving me this treatment. Because I'm a minority, you are not giving me this treatment. That, fortunately, is not the reason doctors withhold treatment. There are few instances, again, it may have happened. But by and large, in this day and age, people who are sick are given treatments. But if the disease is not something which can be treated, the type of disease cannot be treated, then it is absolutely necessary to understand that. And that is the key, having good information which the doctor has to provide you. And doctors fail to do that. And there are many reasons why doctors fail to do that and provide good information to the patients.
And what are some of those reasons?
So one of the big reasons is that doctors throughout their training have been told that you cannot fail. You have to be on your high school, top through college, top through medical school. That's how you get the good job. So you don't want to fail. And if you take the attitude that a patient's death or the progression of a disease is a failure, then you want to avoid that failure. And that is a very big part of doctors' thinking. They just believe in giving every treatment that they have read about. They will go through the journals and find some treatment. They don't look at the details of it. They'll say, oh, well, I've seen this treatment in the book, and it shows that 5% of patients may benefit from this. They don't explain what the benefit is. They don't explain how toxic that treatment is, and really, does it really prolong the life, or does the patient feel better? It just says that in the journal it says 5% chance of benefit, and that's enough for many doctors, and that's not fair to the patient.
But the patient doesn't necessarily understand that because of that patient lack of communication.
Patient does not understand all those details.
You're a retired oncologist. There have been amazing developments in how we treat cancer. And many people now can live with cancer almost as a chronic disease. And instead, before it used to be a death sentence. Now, that's not always the case. Certainly for some cancers it is, but other cancers, as I said, people die with them as opposed to die from them. I mean, what are your thoughts on some of the cancer treatments that we're seeing and the impact that they're having on people's life and quality of life, not just the quantity, the length of life, but the quality of life?
There's no question that there have been a lot of improvements. When I started my my training in oncology, certain diseases like leukemia, the median average survival was about 3 to 6 months. Now the average survival is 3 to 5 years in many cases. And in many, many cases, it is completely cured. As you said, they die with the cancer from something else. But that is not, cancer is not one disease. Cancer is a whole spectrum of diseases. And therefore, one has to understand for each cancer and each subtype of cancer. Just recently, in the last 3-4 years, melanoma and lung cancer have been found to be actually curable by certain types of treatment. But it's not all melanomas, it's not all lung cancer. Only specific types are in that category. And again, your doctor has to explain to you that you are or are not in that category. And therefore, it's again a matter of communication. And it can take long periods of time, half an hour, 1 hour of discussion, for the doctor to tell you and explain to you properly which category you belong to. And doctors often don't have the time. And that is another factor which the medical system imposes on the doctors. They're supposed to see so many patients per day because that's how they get paid by the insurance company or by the institution. And those points come up again and again. But yes, you cannot just say, because I have cancer, I'm going to die. It's certainly not the case.
We're speaking with Dr. Arup Mangalik, who's a retired oncologist, and he has a new book out, Dealing with Doctors, Denial and Death, A Guide to Living Well with Serious Illness. As I mentioned before, you used to practice in Denver, you're now living in Albuquerque, and Colorado just recently passed a medical aid in dying measure. It was voter approved after several attempts to get some type of similar legislation passed through the state legislature. New Mexico, where you now live, has had its own efforts at that. I mean, what are your thoughts on medical aid in dying, and particularly how it's communicated? Because we've talked about this before, language is key. Opponents of this label it as assisted suicide because of such negative connotations with the word suicide. Proponents say it's medical aid in dying. You are dying, you're just getting medical aid in that process. What are your thoughts?
I think it's very important to understand that the whole idea, the movement about aid in dying, and many other names have been given, including death with dignity, but these are the two terms which explain the term properly. The basic point about this whole movement is that if the patient and no one else, if the patient feels that if they're going to die very soon from the illness anyway, why should they stay alive unnecessarily for those period of time? Even if they have some degree of control of their pain and other symptoms, there are many things which hurt the patient, and the patient feels hurts the family. And the patient says, why delay things when I can do it now? And that is the key to the whole movement supporting aid in dying. As you said, calling it assisted suicide is just trying to put a negative spin on the process, and it is not fair. Aid in dying is for patients who want it, and of course there are restrictions on it. Everybody just can't say, oh, I got sore on my finger and I want to kill myself. That's not the point. The point is that you have an illness which is going to kill you in the near future. You should have the right to decide how and when you die.
Well, tying this element back to our previous conversation about how death is considered failure by most doctors, I know a lot of palliative care physicians come out in opposition to medical aid in dying because they see it as a failure of, you know, the palliative care movement, that a lot of people who say that they would choose some type of medical aid in dying, fear of pain at the end of life seems to be a huge component of that, where palliative care doctors say we can manage pain, so that should not be part of the decision-making process. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, there are two points on that. Number one is the whole idea of failure. And failure in the society as a whole is not acceptable. I mean, we don't look upon people who don't get the best jobs and the best amount of money. We think of them as inferior people. Society as a whole, I'm talking about. And the same thing is for doctors who are treating cancer or other diseases and the palliative care doctors. They think and they say that they can control all kinds of pain, which is not really true, because pain, when you're talking about pain from a broken bone or a pain from after surgery, that is something, yes, you can easily control with pain medication. But there are other kinds of pain, the shortness of breath. And then there is the whole feeling of, using a big word, existential pain, which is something which people feel. They say, why am I sitting here waiting to die? And that kind of pain is also there. The palliative care physicians consider it to be their failure if they can't control the pain. But there are other, since there are situations where palliative care physicians cannot control the patient's pain except by putting them into a coma. And putting a patient into a coma is no better than putting a patient at a situation where they can choose their death. To be put in a coma where you are not able to interact with your family, you are still suffering internally because whatever is causing the pain is still going on, is not helpful to anybody. So I am a very strong supporter of the movement for aid in dying.
And what's happening in New Mexico with that?
In New Mexico, we tried to do that about 3 years ago. We did it through the court system, and we unfortunately were rejected by the state Supreme Court on the basis of a constitutional part of the law. So now this is going through the New Mexico legislature, which is starting its session next week. In early January, it will start the session, and we are hoping to introduce a bill into that session to have a discussion on the on this issue, and hopefully we will have a positive hearing on it and a positive verdict. But also we are hoping that by discussing it in the legislature, we will have more information to the public who might give us more support, and that might help the legislature to help.
Well, as we finish up our conversation today, your book, Dealing with Doctor's Denial and Death, A Guide to Living Well with Serious Illness, that concludes with resources that ill patients and their families can actually call upon to get support and assistance with all of these different challenges that we've talked about. And it runs the gamut from, you know, the logistics of navigating a very convoluted medical system, the emotional challenges, the spiritual challenges. What can people do if somebody's listening today and they're faced with a serious illness and they want to live well with it, but also die well as well, with all of these issues that we've been talking about? How can they have better communication with their doctor? How can they institute all of these changes that you say need to happen?
I think the most simple and yet most difficult aspect of this issue is taking control. Don't forget, it is your life, it is your death, and you should take control over it. But society as a whole, and for a very long time, doctors have been put on a pedestal. And many, many patients, even people who have a strong personality, when they go in front of a doctor, they become docile and accept whatever the doctor says. You have to fight that tendency in yourself and say, it is my life, I want to know all the details. So you ask the doctor about the medical illness, what are the chances of benefit from the treatment that you are being prescribed, what are the chances of being alive for a longer time? What are the chances of being helped and feeling comfortable while before you die? Then you say, okay, I've chosen to take the treatment or not to take the treatment. If you choose not to take the treatment, the doctor should have, and I'm sure they do have, the information. There are social workers, nurses, hospice people, and palliative care people in every facility of any size all over the country now. So insist and tell the doctor, I want the facilities to be used. I want the palliative care doctor to come in. I want the social worker to help me find different ways in which I can be comfortable. I want to be at home. I want the hospice people to help me stay at home, and they can provide me with all the facilities that I need to be comfortable at home. And of course, part of all this is communication. And we've been talking about communication with the doctors, but a big part of the communication is communication with the family. If you don't communicate with your family and don't communicate with that kind of information and discussion multiple times, your family will have somebody who may object to what you have said. And it's your life. And just like you tell the doctor what you choose, you tell the family what you choose and convince them that it is in your interest that you not go undertake this particular treatment and go for comfort. So getting the whole family in, and your circle of friends, getting them into the picture is very helpful. Once you have done that communication, then you can dictate how you will die and how you will live.
Well, Dr. Arup Mangalik's new book is Dealing with Doctors, Denial and Death, A Guide to Living Well with Serious Illness, and it's being released this month, January 2017. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.